This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today, folks, we're going to be taking a journey with a real adventurer. As those of you who are longtime Dreamland listeners know, we don't really go on armchair adventures on this show. If we're going to have an adventurer on here, he's going to have to be someone who actually went there and did that, and that is the case today. We're going to be talking to Alex Chianetti. He's got a new book called Mysteries of the Taos Caves. Doug Preston, who is, as you probably know, the author of The Lost City of the Monkey God, a huge bestseller, says, an utterly fascinating book from beginning to end, a gripping read, and that is the truth. Let me begin by setting the scene, if I may. From the prologue to this book, these caves, meaning the Taos Caves, are more than just mysterious caverns hidden deep in the Amazon jungle. In only half a century, countless enigmas have surfaced around them, all told by bizarre characters that could be described as crazy, holy, intrepid, or pathological criminals. Are their stories all true, or are they a plethora of lies? Welcome to Dreamland, Alex Chianetti, who is going to separate the wheat from the chaff for us expertly. Alex, I'm so glad to have you on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. It's a good honor to be with you in this show. Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah.
Well, wonderful. Thank you. Can you begin by telling us, just, we're going to start at the beginning, where you started on this adventure. What attracted you to the idea of the Taos Caves in the first place? And folks, we'll find out more about what they are over the course of the show.
Oh, yeah, it's a long story. I will try to condense, but since a teenager, I was interested in mysteries. And at an early age, I wrote my first book, Parallel Worlds, Mundos Paralelos. And one of the chapters was about the interterrestrial. Well, one big section of the book, the first section was about the interterrestrial worlds, the subterranean or the underground world. But it was a book about parallel dimensions and more into your alley. But through a friend of mine said, "Oh, Mr. Aguado, I want to meet you." And in one of the chapters, I mentioned this person, and this person was an explorer, and a speleologist, and a spelunking who went in the 60s and the 70s. To this area, and I went to meet, and we turned friends, and he was Julio Goyen Aguado, and he was the person who escorted Neil Armstrong to descend in the caves, our former first man in the moon, former astronaut, to descend to the moon of the Earth in 1976, when one of the extended expedition in the history of speleology and also natural science took place. And well, this took place with the subject of the caves airborne to the public opinion through a bestseller of 1970-74 by Eric von Däniken, The Goal of the Gods. And that attracted the public attention and the world attention, and this Scottish engineer created this very extensive investigation of the caves, and the godfather was Neil Armstrong. And as my friend was already involved with all the story and was one of the main protagonists of the story, he was participant.
How did you meet him?
Well, through a close friend of mine, he said, "Oh, Mr. Aguado want to go to visit, but you look like you wrote." And I went to see him in the office, the Center of Argentinian Speleology, and I found this kind of very serious person. He says, "Well, why you are writing about me? What is your interest on this?" Yeah, but not too many people are interested in this story. No, well, I found in a magazine when I was researching for my book, and my book had to be with the underground war, with the subterranean and research of caves. But I didn't know this organization was also a front of a more serious kind of a group. This group was more also a kind of an initiatic one. And he had been exploring caves along the Andes, and with another research and explorers, Juan Morix, he had the concept that below the Andes was an advanced civilization who had been living for thousands of years, and also a human civilization with also, we could say, a good spiritual evolution, no? And he sent us to experiment, spend time in the darkness, in kind of an isolation type of experiment, in one cave called Cave of the Witches. And that was my first kind of interest. But before, years before, and also it's in my first book, I was intrigued by this strange group of Indians called Comechingones, who were, they live in the center of Argentina, and they live in underground kind of dwellings. And also they create, there were artists and also sensitive, we could say, what they paint, mirror paintings of the sky, of the southern sky. And the sky was, well, the paintings connect constellations, and they were very advanced in astroarchaeology. And there was a big mystery. It's an extinct race, no? And it's a long story. That was my first kind of interest in with the intraterrestrial war and the connection. No, I was attracted to these cultures who were below, and we didn't know where they come. Yeah. And also, well, in that time, the theory of the ancient astronauts, of course, affect all of the teenagers in the space age, no? As we were start to look the stars, no?
Yeah, you're a member of the Explorers Club. Had you run across Catherine Cook by any chance?
Catherine Cook sounds familiar.
Yeah, she was the president of it for a while. And she's a close friend and was the niece of the man who made the first Yeti expedition, Tom Slick.
And Thomas Slick, yes. I read the book of Lauren Coleman about the Slick expedition.
Slicks were not close, but friends of my family when I was growing up. And so I was very aware of that whole strain. So seeing that you were in the Explorers Club, I thought I would ask.
Now, right. No, that I think it was before my time. But we have the sculp of the Yeti in the third floor of the upper floor on the Explorers Club, an exhibition.
Yes,
a donation from Edmund, Sir Edmund Hillary, no? Yeah, but it looks like it's fake, no?
you also have discovered lost cities. Before we go on, we're going to take a brief break for our free Dreamlanders, and we'll be right back.
In 2015, Whitley Strieber entered a whole new level of contact, and his new book, A New World, tells the powerful and revealing story of what's been happening. Read about contact experiences unlike you have ever heard described before. Learn about the breakthroughs in communication that are developing right now. Experience the wonder of seeing into a mirror universe. The thrill of discovering the close encounter experience in an entirely new way. And learn the secret of how Whitley has built a very real and ongoing relationship with our otherworldly visitors. One Amazon reviewer says, a significant document of human empowerment. Another, one mind-bending, reality-shifting read. Another, outstanding. Get A New World today, available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
People often ask about the sensing exercise that I'm describing in A New World and how it builds a connection with other levels of reality. Well, I explain that very carefully in the subscriber area of unknowncountry.com. And not only that, there are a large number of meditations that I have used over the years that are available for your use now in unknowncountry.com's subscriber area. And there is so much more there. Audiobooks of Communion, Transformation, Majestic, The Secret School, my original hypnosis tapes, and so much more, including hundreds and hundreds of Dreamlands, of special interviews, William Henry's great show, Revelations, which had a terrific run on Unknown Country, and Strieber's beautiful Mysterious Powers, the beautiful contactee interviews she did, filled with insight. It's a really wonderful place. unknowncountry.com. So go to the site and click on the subscribe tab today. We're talking to Alex Cianetti, Mysteries of the Taos Caves, and he's a high-level adventurer and explorer. I think that's a fair description of you, isn't it, Alex? In other words, yeah. When I say high level, I mean you go out and you do this. You're a member of the Explorers Club, which has got quite high standards. You can't just join it because it's fun. You have to actually be an explorer.
Right. So, yeah. My credentials with my expeditions in South America brought me to be received by the club. Yes. Now, to enjoy.
You have discovered or participated in the discovery of two lost cities. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Yeah, that has been more in the Peruvian territory, in Peru. After my first expeditions and in connecting with this disappeared culture in the center of Argentina, in Cordoba, I went to study and to research caves along the Andes as the Witches Caves, but following that path going north, as these hypotheses talk about, these caves prolongate, kind of continue to below the Andes through Bolivia, Chile, and Peru. Finally, I arrived in Peru in the 80s, and I start to really climb the high Sierra and the Andes, the Peruvian Andes. And one of my first fascination, also in the same time, as I was working in my first book, was the Plateau of Marcahuasi. The Plateau of Marcahuasi is in the Central Sierra and was discovered by a scholar and an esoteric one. He was not an official archaeologist, named Daniel Russo de los Heros. And in the 50s, he discovered this giant plateau spread with hundreds of sculptures, human and animals. And many scientific expeditions after his discovery, they couldn't explain how these statues mix natural with artificial kind of carving and enhancement, activating solstice and equinox. And in the 21st of June, for example, one of the faces was a giant kind of composed of several faces called the Monument of Mankind or Pekagasha. Really activate, for example, the iris of the eye, and another monument as the lion, and it's a kind of an encyclopedia of zoological and races. You find elements for foreign cultures, and this really kind of killed my sleeping for several decades too between
Marcahuasi.
Yeah, and I did excavations. I was kind of also. Help with some scientific scientific advice from the Smithsonian Institution. And we discovered one kind of, I call the royal tomb with in layers, but also was a legend saying if you enter in the center of the plateau, you finish in the end. Also, there were many tunnels. And Russo was saying he was also visionary, and he was disciple of another Peruvian researcher, Pedro Astete, who have a kind of a vision, but based in his research that this place was a depository of an ancient kind of the treasure of mankind, a kind of an encyclopedic reservoir of books, of manuscripts. Yeah,
in
Markawasi, yes, Markawasi Plateau, and this was kind of an not only in the stone carvings, but in kind of papyri and other documents, but nobody find. But Russo died with the conviction was some kind of vault with a previous kind of previous recollection and salvage from previous mankinds before the deluge, as they have the kind of the tradition, the survivors went to the top of the Andes and also below the Andes to escape from the big cataclysm who took place 10,000-12,000 years ago.
Which is now very thoroughly documented in this world. We even know what caused it. This cataclysm was caused by something along the lines of a comet, which could have been debris from an exploded star. And some scientists have even identified the particular supernova that happened about 40,000 years ago. And the gamma radiation from it caused a wave of extinctions across planet Earth. But then about 12,000 years ago, the more solid matter came into our solar system, and Earth was hit by something that destroyed the Laurentide Glacier and left fires and floods all over the planet. I think you're talking about that, aren't you?
Yes, well, the local Indians, they talk about that legends, no? The survivors, they talk about the giants, yeah, before the regular kind of human groups. But the interesting in this plateau, you have in 2 square kilometers, and 1.5 square miles, you have hundreds of figures. And these figures, you see it with clarity in the solstice and equinox. And we used to call it optical carvings. And this kind of looks like it was the cinema of the prehistory or the protohistory. But, you know, the power of the animal was very important, and they worshipped, no? And right. And also you find this kind of the mother and the son, this kind of also reproduction, the fertilization. We have all these symbols, but one figure, for example, is the representation of the Tawarjet, the Tueris goddess, is the hippopotamus who is pregnant, and you find the representation also of the crocodile, and it's amazing. This is a giant. How you find Egyptian kind of representation in a stone? Yeah, 1,000 years ago. So all the world was connected, and cannot.
The world was connected in some very strange ways. And folks, we're going to take our second break right now. And when we get back, I should say that Alex is going to blow your mind, because we're going to talk about a connection that's been proven that you simply will not believe. It will completely overturn your entire understanding of the way the world works. And that's good. I mean, that's what we're here for. This website, unknowncountry.com, and this show, Dreamland, are all about seeing the world in a new way without going down the garden path of fantasy. We try to stay with what's been proven. And you know what? When you do that, it turns out, reality is even stranger than the fantasies. Now, before we go, subscribers, I want to, and other listeners as well, don't forget, take a look at my new book, A New World. You can find it on Amazon and anywhere ebooks are sold, hardcover, softcover, on audible.com as an audiobook. So do take a look and keep it in mind. We'll be right back.
Whitley's new book, A New World, is getting great reviews. American cosmic author Diana Walsh Pasulka says, "Enter this risky new world and leave empowered." New York Times reporter Leslie Keen says, "Riveting. I couldn't put it down." Amazon reviewers are calling it life-changing, mind-opening, the first real description of what contact is like and will be like. Don't miss A New World. As Professor Jeffrey Kripal says in his preface, this book is contact. Get A New World today. Available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com. Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on Earthfiles.com.
We're talking to Alex Cianetti. His book, The Mystery of the Taos Caves. He's an award-winning journalist, explorer, filmmaker. He's been a consulting producer on Ancient Aliens. His documentaries have been on Fox, NBC, A&E, History Channel, all kinds of networks. He is also, as we talked earlier, a member of the Explorers Club, an organization that I have a lot of respect for because I have dear friends who have been associated with it intimately for many years. Now, I want to get to then not waste any more time here. I want to get to the Shuar and their language and its relation to a European language. Can you explain that to us a little bit? Who they are and talk about their language?
Well, before you ask me about the two lost cities I discovered, near this area of called San Pedro de Casta, I found one very interesting city with underground constructions. And in this vault, I found these famous elongated skulls, you know. And this is a very pristine area, kind of I protected, but I could show you the pictures, you know. That was kind of a decade ago. I found this city connected with the legend of...
Are those elongated skulls related to the ones that have been talked about so much recently in Peru?
Yes, yeah. But this is not in the coast as the other skulls have been founded in the Paracas area. But this is in the Sierra, yeah. And this is very interesting. I found this kind of, vault, this kind of crypt, with the family, and all the family have the elongated skulls, but connected with the legends. It's a very interesting place with the pre-colonial, pre-Hispanic. And the other city was more toward the coast, and I was the first one who arrived who have a lot of terraces, and it's very old, also it's a pre-Inca formation with a lot of kind of stairs, ladders, and constructions, and also, they have a lot of caves and caverns, and very, very old. Yeah, that was the two ones. Coming back to your question, yes, it's very interesting, the linguistic, no? For example, I have to tell the story of Juan Morix. Juan Morix was a Hungarian who was sent to Ecuador by my friend Julio, the one I was starting in the story, to try to continue researching that evidence of the underground culture, this underground civilization. And in his trips, he went to an area called Santo Domingo de los Colorados, where these Indians called Sachilas. There are particular Indians who kind of, you recognize what they put, a kind of a red gel in an orange gel in the head. They were kind of, chatting with him, very friendly. And they saw he have kind of some drawings of his heraldic kind of shield. He come from very aristocrat area from Budapest and from his high Magyar education, and we know the Magyars were a very kind of advanced Indo-European culture around the center.
They're Hungarian. They're part of the Hungarian people.
Right. Yeah. And he started kind of, and they said, oh, you're interested in this bear? And like, we could send you to a place with the Indians worship, and it's very similar to you. But he suddenly started to talk in Hungarians, and the Sachilas, they were answering him in Hungarian. How could be? And he started to find similar toponymians with many names of cities and areas, places, people, as Quito or Guayaquil. They have the same kind of description in some of the older European languages. How come? So America went to Europe, or Europe really arrived before Columbus? But we know Columbus was the last to arrive and was a melt pot of hundreds of cultures navigating from east to west and west to sea through the Atlantic and through the Pacific. And he started to make analogies. There were other researchers, for example, and he was, Morix and Julio, they were based in other Basque scholar, Florencio de Basaldúa, who already make a relation between the Basque language and the Hindi language and the Americas. We found the same kind of words describing the same objects, describing the same nouns and adjectives in the Americas. And that was kind of almost impossible, but that brought Morix to develop his hypothesis of the American origin of the European nations. And with this kind of names, for example, yeah, Quito was, yeah, the center of the universe, and also was the center of the war in the language, in the Magyar language. And I start to kind of feel identify what this is, kind of a big discovery too, in the semantic well, the semantic kind of structures. And it's,
because
it's the race, the cognitive.
It's South America and Hungary, and the two languages are linked.
Yes.
What's extraordinary.
Yes, yeah, a big kind of discovery. And he's today, the scholars and universities are in Hungary are studying the discoveries of Morix. And Morix, after he did the two great discoveries, kind of the Cave of Tajos, the metal library, and the relation between America and Europe, and he was not recognizing his time when he was exploring in Ecuador, and he discovered also the largest gold mine in South America, Cumbaratza, and he lost it, and he died penniless after.
So often, that is the story, isn't it?
Right, yeah. But coming back to the analogies, the Americas were connected. And we could see so much influence in the coast of Ecuador when you find ceramics, traditions, a skeleton sitting in lotus position. We have the Japanese kind of prove the Japanese migration to the Ecuadorian coast. They were navigators, kind of not only Torhegidal, he proved that people could navigate in ancient times with balsa raft, but also primitive navigators come from the Orient to the coast of Ecuador and Peru.
Right. Japanese did, and that's also, I think that's disputed by a lot of North American archaeologists, but I believe it's the evidence is very strong.
Yes, unfortunately, American archaeologists, they dig always in the same pit, and they don't look behind front.
We have a lot of problems in archaeology in North America especially, it's very Eurocentric. In other words, anything that seems improbably advanced in comparison to where European culture was at the time is rejected. So the idea that the Japanese could be have been navigating the Pacific Ocean at a time when in the late Neolithic is just they just don't believe it. Not because it isn't true, but because they think in terms of Europe always and later the European cultures in North America as being the world's most advanced. And it's not true. It's not true at all.
Yeah, exactly. And also, yeah, the pre-Incas navigate north toward Mexico, and there's a connection between the two cultures, the Incas and the Aztecs and the Mayans, and then nobody really explored that situation. And it says, and we have all these Olmecs and the Negroid evidence too. And it's what is the origin? The origin is the Americas, so the origin is kind of North Africa, and still we are kind of fixed with the Bering Strait, and the penetration of the American came from that. But they were already very ancient, kind of advanced cultures beyond the lithic elements in the Paleolithic period.
Right, and you know, the same disaster that we were talking about earlier was much worse in North America than it was in South America, because we have in North American geology something called the Black Mat, which consists of skeletons of plankton and ash that cover most of the United States and much of southern Canada. This is what happened was after that comet hit, the entire continent was set on fire. You talk about the fires in Australia. This fire was monstrous. And then the glacier melted. There was a huge flood, and all of the debris and ash ended up on top of the water, which went down as it's swept into the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico, and leaving this mat, which we can dig up to this day. So it's not a disputed thing. But there was a culture, there were people under that, in that they were totally wiped out. We have no idea what they were like or who they were. But we're going to find out more secrets. We're going to go into the Taos Caves with Alex, who has literally been there and done that, when we get back.
Unknown Country and Dreamland are unique in every way. The site offers over 16,000 news stories dating back 20 years, all of them with our uniquely open-minded and yet carefully researched point of view. You can find stories of everything from lost cities to multiple witness high strangeness events to the cutting edge of science and reality on the site. For subscribers, the site offers a wealth of material that is mind-opening and can be life-changing. Plus, there are active comment sections, both in the free area and the subscriber area, and a free weekly newsletter. Dreamland, which Whitley Strieber has been hosting for over 20 years, is archived on the site back to 2004. This archive is the only one of its kind in the world, an incredible richness of information that offers exciting adventure every time you dig in. So go to unknowncountry.com daily, get our newsletter, participate in the site's social groups, and above all, subscribe and join this unique community today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab to see our options.
Alex, I would like to begin, before we actually go into the caves, to talk about the significance of Ecuador, because you speak about it in such an interesting way in the book. Now, tell me what tell us what its what its significance is in ancient times.
Well, not only in ancient times, Ecuador, is a small country, but it's part of the Andes, it's part of the center. The focus of the past, of past cultures who are not totally well known, and also the equatorial line. And it's interesting, the French measured the equatorial line 250 years ago, like on the mean, yeah. And that was the geodesic measure of the war in that time. But the funny things, in more recent years, equatorial researchers and Mr. Cobo, they found what they were constructions kind of two blocks, kind of half of a mile from the equatorial meridian, no?
Right.
The amazing thing is this culture of the Kituskaras, they measure with perfection. Today, if we measure the Ecuador with more instruments, they are coincidental with that two blocks difference, and the two blocks difference, we have circular lines measuring in this hill called Catequilla Hill, who is very close to the famous monument of the war, no? Of the measure of the war, of the line of the war. Separate the North Hemisphere from the South Hemisphere. Yeah.
And somebody clearly knew that in very ancient times.
Yes, these Indian groups, a couple thousand years ago, they already measure the line. And these lines project to the east, passing the Andes to the Amazon. So they have a perfect knowledge of the skies and the measure of the earth in their precognitive. They don't have really too much measurement instruments, but they have a different interpretation of the war, where the cognition was totally different, connected with the senses. And the strange things, many of these monuments, they are activated with in the solstice and the equinox. They have the orientation also to the zenith. For example, not too far from the center of the war, there are the Pyramid of Cochasqui. They are the largest pyramids in Ecuador. And these, they are oriented to the Ursus Major and Ursus Major. There are kind of many lines carved and on kind of cooking dirt to measure, for example, the solstice. And this kind of, the people of the sun, they have kind of very kind of advanced and natural way to measure. And these lines continue to the east, and many other cultures, they were coming from the west, through the Amazon, through the Mato Grosso, and they were looking for converge in this kind of eyebrow of the jungle. And we found, for example, in the bottom of the Cave of Tajos, we found a spondylus, who is the shell, the very reverend shell worshipped by many cultures of the coast and the Sierra, but it was a pink, very transparent and vivid color shell, no? And that proved the connection of the Pacific with the Sierra and thing. And it was a kind of a precious object. Yeah, people with some royalty or transcendence, they keep this in their belongings. But following these lines, and it's not only the Nazca lines, we have these projections into the Huacas, into the Jeques, who their ceremonial things and connect. The empire was Cusco, and from the Cusco irradiate to north, east, west, and if you follow the lines, you connect religion, spiritual knowledge, initiation, with also social kind of quotidian daily life surviving. Yeah, also kind of not only water reservoirs, but also places of food and concentration of small cultures and extended ones, no? And this is very, very interesting. We cannot really interpret all the pre-Inca war, no? I said 3,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. And the Incas, for example, they were heritors of a previous knowledge. And we have layers and layers. For example, everybody goes to Machu Picchu, but nobody imagined that Machu Picchu have another very thousand years of layers of previous cultures and also cultures who have the condition to manipulate, to dissolve the rocks and adapt it with their hands and with substance we cannot isolate until today, no? And we have also, we have many massive tunnels running along the Andes, as a group, a friend of mine had been proving the connection between Cusco and Sacsayhuaman, no? And going also more thousands of miles. And we don't know that. And they connect also with Campagnan, who is the Inca roads. The Inca roads were not only in the surface, but were also below the surface. Yeah. And but unfortunately, we don't have field investigation, and we are only few with all our limited budgets who had been exploring the Sierra and the jungle. And the Tajos was also one converging line who brought me to try and kind of to prove this, the existence of the of this ancient world, no? And I know there were many others. When I started, we were few ones, but we converged with other researchers, Graham Hanko, for example, who had been also pursuing this mother culture for so many years too, and the evidence of carving it, and the Tajos expedition, who took me several decades, brought me to find the evidence of this underground city. Yeah.
You know, when you look at the world of the past, and you see things like the connection between ancient Greek and Phoenician language, this mm-hmm. connection between the Shuar language and Hungarian, you see evidence in both South America and in Northern Europe of the presence of the Egyptians and so much else around the world, including structures like the Great Pyramid or the fortress at Sacsayhuaman or mm-hmm. and so many others that we have no idea now how to build. You realize we live in the shattered remains of a civilization. We are the remnants of something. Mm-hmm. This is not the pinnacle of anything. And and when you talked about they're having an almost internal ability to do these measurements and so forth, you were talking about something that most of us have lost. We've been blinded. Does that mm-hmm. make any sense to you? Do you respond to that, Alex?
Oh, yes. No, it's a big drama. So we wish we have a kind of the condition of remote viewing or the psychic archaeology, who also explore in my book, as a kind of an instrument, as we could go to the past instead to be spying the enemy. It's why we cannot develop this condition, as archaeologists have only C14 and the importance of the chronologies. We don't know any chronologies, and nobody cares really how. And it's, the chronologies go back and create a big kind of void to resolve the mysteries. You could see it, as I said, the ancient cultures have different cognitive processes as us, and we didn't have information, and we are intoxicated with tons of information, and our filters of reality cannot really. No matter we try to apply the scientific method, we're still the stick of the blind. But the only thing who survive is the rock, and is the message of the rock and the stones. And for example, the Incas didn't leave, neither the pre-Incas leave any kind of writing scripture, and that is a big right. mystery. But they have the perfection to be advanced architects, yeah, and engineers. And I say, where are the scrolls? As coming back to the beginning of the talk with Russo trying to find this concentration of scrolls would could be the testament of these ancient cultures, but we couldn't find either the testament. The testament is the three-dimensional rocks and formation. Right. That for me was so important. And coming back to the Tajos story, and in the picture is in the book, Julio showed me a few years before his death, when we're going to go to an expedition and being here, the living witness of all this story, a kind of a stone, a corner, the cornerstone. And this, when I saw this cornerstone, this is an architectonical technique supporting a big megalith. It was in the deep of the Tajos Quangos cave. Yeah, who was the? This cave was the one I said attract the interest in the past. Yeah, of the expedition.
You have to ask 76. What it was doing there.
Right, and it's and he didn't see it, and he is in the expedition when he descended with Neil Armstrong. He didn't see it and said, "Well, Julio, we have to back and see." Well, this is the proof of artificial. But previous expeditions said, "No, it's a natural formation. It's karst. It's a limestone. It's the andesite capricious." No, no. The geology doesn't make very perfect blocks cut. This could be circular.
They basically
the fluvial.
They just didn't see it for what it was.
Right, in my kind of. Tough expedition of years ago, finally, before I exit and before the sunrise, I found the cornerstone, and the picture is in the book, and I said, and since then, I defend, but I always have my doubt of the artificially of this kind of citadel, but when I said, if the entrance of the threshold of a stone gate have two kind of supportive cornerstones, this is architecture. This is not nature. This is not Mother Nature. It's not the fluvial erosion of the water. No, señor. And that killed me looking in the faith, and I continue. But Julio was a very honest man who never profited with anything. Also, he finished very low in the last days of his life before another expedition killed himself, and I continue his work. And he was a witness of the finding of the metal library, and before his fall in bad hands, they decide to hide that entrance, and it's still unresolved. No matter, we have other personal clues toward the big mystery, you know. And I try to analyze step by step in my book, but there were many kind of goose chases and disinformations and kind of conspiracy authors. And then since I put the cave in, when I produced that segment for Ancient Aliens, I regret in many degrees, but they only focus in the Anglo part, but not in the Latin part. Was before, and I have to fight. I couldn't control my own segment, unfortunately. And you know how is television, no?
When we come back, Free Dreamlanders, we're going to talk about some of the structures in the cave. As Alex has been describing, I've been looking at the illustrations in the book, which are color illustrations, and they're very, very interesting. And we're going to ask him some questions about those. And then later on in the show, we're going to go into the legends of the Taos Caves in the final half hour of the show. But first, listen up.
The new unknown country is here, and it has so much to offer. Our huge archive of Dreamland, plus the full run of William Henry's Revelations, Anne Streber's Mysterious Powers and her incredible contactee interviews, Whitley's Communion, Secret School, Transformation, and Majestic ebooks, his powerful meditations, and so much more. Plus, every week, the full subscriber versions of Whitley's Dreamland, Mike Clellan's The Unseen, and monthly, Jeremy Vaney's The Experience. We offer subscriptions either by credit card or PayPal. Either automatic renewal or annual or longer subscriptions without auto-renew. Plus, it's easy to cancel if you wish. Do it right in your account. plus a live chat every week on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific, and so much more. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and subscribe. Keep this incredible site going and have a great time doing it.
UnknownCountry.com subscribers have access to a vast treasury of information. Listen to what Dr. Robert Schock said. He's an expert on the past, and for that reason, he also knows a great deal about the future.
We are re-entering, as you say, a debris field, and when you have a debris field like this, it enters the solar system, it energizes the solar system as you have things going into the sun, even clouds of dust particles, for instance, it will energize the sun, it will destabilize the sun. This is what we saw at the end of the last ice age in approximate terms, about 13,000 years ago.
And just in the past few days, more enormous meteors have been sighted. And this goes on continuously, more and more every year. We live in a time of great change in a world that doesn't like to look at things as they are. UnknownCountry.com offers extraordinary information, a vast archive that you cannot find anywhere else. Subscribe today. Help keep this website going, because without you, there is and can be no us. Go to unknowncountry.com right now. Click on the subscribe tab. Get started.
We're talking to Alex Chianetti. His new book, Mysteries of the Taos Caves, The Lost Civilizations Where the Andes Meet the Amazon. And when I look and I see, for example, plate 26, stone steps cut with laser precision, how do you know that they are cut? Can you describe what you've, the research that's been done to prove that these are indeed cut steps? And also, where do they lead?
Well, the steps, they don't lead anywhere. Anywhere. They go up to a kind of a platform, and I think couldn't be a ritual kind of mesa or kind of table. And the people use it. It's not, they had three or four steps, but the other ones coming down, always in the tree group, and this is the area before the room of the stalactites, of the giant stalactites. You cannot really apply any kind of method, only through visual observation. But you could see the cut is very kind of very precise. And it's and not also, a natural. It's not the natural breakdown. It's
no, it doesn't look natural, but it also looks incredibly old.
Yes, that is. You feel the sensation is we are very, very in the protohistory, as I said. Yeah, the history before the prehistory. So yeah, you feel the heaviness of the centuries and the millenniums.
Yes.
In your shoulders. And unfortunately, yeah, they are not techniques. I'm trying to kind of find people to help me to create the new technologies to analyze the rocks. But as we cannot apply the C14, how we measure. But and the water doesn't produce this time of erosion of the steps or more angles, kind of 90 degrees angles. Yeah, kind of. Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I understand. You know, I want to get back to Moritz and his role in all of this, because something very curious about it. Janos Moritz is a Hungarian, a Magyar, as you said.
Yes.
And this very ancient language is connected somehow to Hungary. And I, you know, you were talking a little bit, you touched on the sort of intuitive level of all of this, and I want to know what happened to draw a Hungarian to this particular place in modern times.
Well, as I was trying to kind of reconstruct, Morix kind of left Europe after the end of the Second World War. We know very little. I tried to establish a trip to Hungary to continue digging the history of Morix, and had been delaying that, but other scholars had been, but we couldn't find too much info about what happened. Some people said he was connected with the famous Anher, the Nazi kind of intellectual elite who also were interested in the Andes and the power of, they used to call the Brill, no? The Brill kind of energy who maybe lift the rocks. And that is, but we don't have evidence that they said he was prisoner also of the Nazis, but and he learned through them later. But he showed up in Argentina in the 50s. He immigrated and he connected with my friend when they were looking about to study the origin of the Basque through these books of Basaldúa and the National Library with Julio. And they started. This friendship started to mix science with esoteric and ancient cultures. And he brought all this kind of, he have already studies in philology. And this kind of philology connect with his search of between philology and also speleology. It was kind of a mix, interesting mix, no? But he was into that. But in the tradition of Morix, he talked about the Taltos, it kind of an also an advanced culture who were kind of a shifter type of creatures who lives beyond the Carpaths, beyond the Urals, and beyond the Central Europe, and mixing with the mythologies of Central Europe. And when he arrived to Santo Domingo, they said, well, you have the symbol of the bird. In his coat, the arm, he have a double head bear, who is very traditional in the European heraldics, no? I said, well, go to this cave. And I said, and he went to the Orient, and the people start to talk about the Tajos. Tajos are oil birds. And the species is kind of called also the Caripes, Huacharos, yeah, Aves Guaneras. Originally, these birds were discovered or first explored by Alexander von Humboldt when he explored Venezuela. And outside of Venezuela, Caracas, you find one of the bigger caves of this birds, but these birds are almost bats, vampires.
Right, they're blind, and
they are totally blind, and they use eco-sonar.
But they don't look like bats at all.
No, they are beautiful, kind of between doves and more doves. But they are blind; they don't see you, but they flow in big packs over you, and nobody they pass very close to your hair. And they don't touch it. And the funny thing is you hear this echo sonar, tac, 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 tac. And they produce this kind of sound, which is almost in a state, they put you in a state of consciousness, altered state of consciousness, where it's a constant buzz, vibration, no? A constant vibration in kind of the 24 hours. But the parents go to kind of look for seeds outside of the caves, and they have to fly kind of hundreds of feet and return with the babies are still kind of waiting. They continue producing this vibration, no? It's a constant. It's not silence, the caves. You think you're going to find silence in the cave, but the system of Tejos caves from Venezuela to Ecuador, and they are along all the Andes, you will find this kind of constant murmur, the vibration. and produced also by the echo sonar. You feel tac-tac, similar to what you feel when you swim with dolphins underwater, no? You kind of feel in your body the sonar waves that are kind of launching over you. Yeah. And again, the symbol of the Taltos, Tallos, the names are similar. They're coincidental, no? And Morix was thinking this, the Taltos, also called, he called the Belas, they live underground. And for him, they have machines who have the capacity of drill, to kind of drill and kind of, excavate tunnels. And again, is why there, as there were many catastrophes in the past, some kind of peoples went up to save from the flood in the deluge, other went down. But it looks like why they went down, why they have to create this kind of almost atomic shelter of construction, no? And for him, he was part, he understood, but in the tradition of the Magyars and the legends was also the existence of these beings. Also, they have the conditions to be winged beings. That is the connection between the physical animal representation of the Tallos and the Taltos Belas of Morix. Yeah, also that was part of his folkloric thing. And the Indians, they consider the Tallo as a kind of a guardian angel of the caves. And in the legends, for example, the legends of the genesis of the Shuars, the Jivaros, who they used to come from, in anthropological point of view, come from the Marañón area. And the Marañón is a kind of a very important affluent of the Amazon. And that is, the convergence is not too far from the Tallos caves. And these tribes coming from the east, coming back also the Amazon kind of, the Amazon River coming to the, running to the west.
Right.
Is brought the, this kind of group, ethnias of the, we used to call Jíbaros, and you know, the Shuars before they were called Jíbaros. And the Jíbaros, you remember, they enter in the folk story as the shrunkers, the people who shrink the head of the enemies.
Right, yes.
Yeah, and in the old Hollywood movies, no? But yeah, now,
but they call it short.
Yes.
They didn't do that.
Yes, they used to shrunk the heads. Yes, oh, but they now, did. Yes, of course, that was a practice. Yeah, and we have many interesting recordings. The other character who is part of the story, the Father Crespi, who was the first filmmaker who filmed these ceremonies of the shrunking of the head. Yeah, when they hunt. Oh, wow. They have the enemies, and they have the technique
with that's using paper to film those ceremonies.
Right. The only two groups in the world, the Papua in New Guinea, they have that kind of tradition of headhunters.
Right.
Yeah. And who shrunk the heads, and the Shuars. Yeah, the previous Shuars, what you used to call Jíbaros. No, as you could find many Hollywood movies about the Jíbaros shrinking the head of the American explorers. But coming back to the legend, yes, the legends are very rich in the Shuar nation, and they were two brothers. The first couple, the first kind of genesis, it's always two brothers. Also in the pre-Inca. In the origin of the Incas and in the origin of also the Amazonic tribes. And these two brothers, they get lost in the caves, but they were escaping from a tiger. And this area have a lot of leopard. The tiger eat one of the twin brothers, but the other escaped. Thanks, a Tallo bear guide him to the surface. And the surface was climbing back this 80-foot entrance. Already, that is the reason the Tallos Cave of the Quangos, is so important, but this has been the almost the St. Peter, the cathedral, the main temple for this nation. But the first narrative of the Schwarz connect the story of the Genesis. And the area have more than 100 caves of Tajus. But this is the main one, kind of the, we could say this, the Vatican St. Peter kind of thing. And where you find also the bigger quantity of packs of Tajus Verde, and the Tajus, they have a communion with these birds, but they eat it two times a year. The Federation, the Shuar Federation, allows to the people to go and harvest. Yeah, it also coincidental with equinox and solstice, and they go almost in a pilgrimage to harvest using very big ladders and to retrieve it and eat it inside of the cave or outside, no? And they are very tasty.
You've eaten them, of course.
I have to eat it, but if not, that was very, was an almost religious offering by my Shuar guides. I didn't want to disappoint them.
Well, we have reached the end of the first hour of Dreamland, and at this point, our free Dreamlanders, we must say goodbye to you, sadly, and I always hope that you will subscribe to unknowncountry.com and begin to enjoy the absolute wealth of information and activity there. You can enjoy the free message boards. You can comment. You can become a member of our very active chat group. And it's a really fun and quite extraordinary place to be. So Alex Cianetti has his new book, Mysteries of the Taos Caves. You can pick it up at your bookstore. You can get it, I'm sure, on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, wherever you shop for books. And you should get it because it is a mind opener. It opens you to a truth. And the truth is, we don't know who we are anymore. We've lost the thread. We've dropped the thread. When one of the visitors said, "Children of the northern peoples, you wander in eternal darkness," that's the truth. The only way to find our way out of that is to try to pick the thread up. And it is in places like the Taos Caves, that thread still lies waiting for us to lean down and pick it up. Subscribers, we will keep right on keeping on.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.